access number 28678, it's Dermot Road, Reel 11. Now, what happened when you joined the ship? How long did it take you to get your grip on the ship as second in command, well, first lieutenant?
It never seemed very long. I mean, the turnover was about 3 days. Gradually, during those 3 days, you saw less and less of your predecessor because he left you to get on with it and left you with the experts on board. And then you had experts running every department. I mean, I had a lieutenant commander, engineer officer, a lieutenant supply officer running all the supply stores, catering, pay, pensions. I had a lieutenant commander, weapons engineer, running all the weapon systems. A pilot flying the helicopter and an observer. We had the seaman team, and I had a gunnery officer, another lieutenant commander, gunnery specialist. I had a TAS torpedo officer. There was another lieutenant specialist. There was a navigator lieutenant and a communications officer who was happened to be a special duties list sub-lieutenant who come up from the ranks.
So was it your job to make sure all these specialists work well together?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, the commander ran the ship's program. He would submit the program. I mean, overall, the program of where the ship went and what it did was run from fleet, and the captain, of course, had very much a say in that. But the day-to-day program was formulated and started by the first lieutenant with the inputs from his various specialists. And every day, the first lieutenant would, through his office, issue what we call daily orders, which
and what were daily orders?
Which is
what were the
daily orders were issued, as the name suggests, on a daily basis, and they were the ship's program for that day. And they would include who were the duty personnel, who was the duty watch, a timetable of events that affected the conduct of the ship in any respect during the day, or items of interest, and that could be anything, because the daily orders appeared in harbour as well as at sea, like sports teams going ashore, or stores coming alongside, or at sea meeting other ships, or passing interesting points, land points, and it would also include notes with items of particular interest, almost any items, and also we used to run a daily orders tombola. We used to have a series of tombola numbers every day. And we'd all buy tickets every week, the first one to get a house got a percentage of the estate. The ship's welfare fund, which was a fund to help make life a little better for aspects of ship activities, whether it's sporting or anything else, also got a cut from that. So that was daily orders, and they were all contained in a large book and manuscript, or typed and stuck in, and they were approved by the first lieutenant every evening and published that evening for the next day.
Anything else about the aspects of your role?
The other aspects, first lieutenant is very much involved in discipline. His right hand, there are two right hand men for the first lieutenant. One was the chief boatswain's mate, or commonly known as the buffer. It was a chief petty officer, normally a seaman, who was responsible for the upkeep and maintenance of the ship's structure, the appearance of the ship. And this was very much the first lieutenant's province, because if the ship was not clean and sparkling and tidy, then the captain would very soon get very uptight and upset about it. And it was up to the first lieutenant to make sure this was carried out. And so the chief boatswain's mate and his team looked after that. The other guy that the first lieutenant relied on tremendously was his master at arms, and he was the disciplinarian, who, with his very small staff, the leading regulator or a regulating petty officer, were all members of the ship's police, if you like, who ran the disciplinary side from top to bottom, and they would identify any offenders or requestmen, and they would be brought forward, and the master at arms would virtually decide whether whatever they'd done or whatever they wanted was deemed worthy to be seen by higher authority. And there was a chain through the officer watch, first lieutenant, and then the captain for both requestmen. These were people who were wanting things like promotion or anything else like that that was quite important. And the offenders likewise. Major offences were dealt with by the captain, but the first lieutenant could also deal with a range of them. And he had a range of punishments that he was allowed to award. So that was that. And so the first lieutenant had a finger in every pie on board. And he should and did, at least I did, got to know everybody on board in a fairly short space of time, and spent quite a lot of his time just going around the ship, keeping your finger on the pulse and watching things. For the captain, and certainly at sea, the first lieutenant would go on evening rounds every evening.
Now, what would a typical evening round around the Bacchante be like?
Well, the first thing would be, and I'm just trying to remember what sort of time we had evening round. 7 o'clock, I think. 7 o'clock. The master at arms, or occasionally a regulator, maybe also, would appear at your cabin dressed in his evening rig, his clothes, together with a bosun's mate with a pipe. And you, and then you would go around all the mess decks and all the ships, heralded by this chap blowing his bosun's call to warn people who were coming, and you would inspect them all, and they had to be tidy, and people properly dressed in their evening rig. I mean, they used to change. They were not allowed to stay around in their dirty old clothes all day. They had to get very clean sailors, actually. They got very used to this. And you'd go around, and I found that advantage of that is that yet again you were seeing everybody, and you could have a little chat with them, find out how they were, not for long, or maybe not at all in some, but you get a sense of who you could talk to and who needed talking to. And then after that you would then go and report the rounds to the captain, and this was when the first lieutenant would pass on to the captain his impression of how things were going. If there were any particular feelings that he detected, or problems, or quite often what I used to try, and this, I mean, I did this job again later on in an aircraft carrier, try to find some amusing incident that had happened to you during the day, and that's not difficult to find that when you're working with sailors, just to tell the captain, because it makes it more interesting for him. Because particularly at sea, the captain is tends to be stuck up on the bridge or in the sea cabin most of the time.
Now, what happened? So you joined at Puerto Rico.
She was in the Caribbean. And we did a number of sort of flag-sharing visits there. We used to
you now what were they like? I mean, you've told us about them when you were younger and sort of a snotty type thing. Now, what were they like now you were a senior officer?
Well, very different when you were second in command, because you were responsible then, really, for the whole thing. We would have a program. We'd go and visit an anchor off an island, and we could have a tea party or a cocktail party. On some rare occasions, we'd do both. Go to one island for a tea party, then go on to the next one for a cocktail party. And actually, it got quite tiring, because you had to run boats to get people on and off unless you could get alongside. The officers, the ship had to be immaculate, the wardroom had to be immaculate. Quite often in places like that, you had them on the upper deck, in which case you had to rig the big awning up and a ceremonial striped awning, make it look nice. You had decorations, maybe even flowers sometimes. Then you would be, well, I would always brief the officers beforehand on the sort of people who were coming, VIPs, named VIPs, things to look forward to, and I always used to warn them that I didn't want the single officers trapping the single girls in a corner all evening. They'd be in trouble if they did. And I didn't mind them ending up talking to the single girls in the end of the party, but I didn't want them beginning doing this. And then there was a routine we used to have for meeting all the guests and making sure they were met properly, handed on, and then passed around, and that people circulated, their hosts circulated, and so did the stewards with the refreshments. And they were looked after for a number of reasons. First of all, this was the whole idea. It was common courtesy and politeness to look after your guests. This was another country, and we wanted to create a good impression. And right down at the bottom of the list was the possible chance that if you were good learned, made a good impression, you might be invited out to dinner by one of these people. And that often happened, or invited out next day to go swimming or something like that. But it was always quite... I mean, it's not just having a party and having a laugh. It was quite a strenuous affair, having an official cocktail party. And everywhere we went, we had an official cocktail party. And the odds were we would be entertained back ashore with another official cocktail party. So that was two evenings of your visit.
Quite a lot. Would you not drink much at these do's?
No, learn very quickly. I used to get... I was very, very strict on people who drank too much, and they knew this. Whether it was cocktail parties or any other time. There are times for enjoying yourself, but you have to remember you're still on a warship, which is full of pitfalls for the unwary. And I didn't normally have to warn people about drinking. Sometimes, very occasionally, I would take an individual on one side and tell him to watch it, or if he'd had enough.
Now, what next then, or any stories from that time?
Well, we went round a number of these islands, and that was a great place for what we used to call a banyan, when we would all go ashore. We'd anchor off some beach and then go ashore taking a barbecue and some beer, the whole ship's company in the boats. Well, we'd have to leave some on board, obviously, and just have an afternoon swimming, walking, having a beer or two, singing maybe, and having a barbecue, and then coming back. We saw the last of, I think it was then, HMS Bermuda, which was just running down as a dockyard then, a major base.
Anything about that, or...?
We went to... Sorry?
Anything about the running down of HMS Bermuda?
No, we weren't really involved, and it was just... You know, it's a pity we were losing it. Then we went off and visited the States. And we went to Jacksonville in Florida, which was interesting. That was a big American base. And that was sort of R&R of it, really. Lots of sports and going around.
What was it, was that the purpose, R&R?
Yeah.
And why was it interesting? Or was it
a liaison with the American. Well, it was interesting seeing an American base and seeing a little bit of the States.
And what next?
And then we went to South America, an island off Colombo. Is it Colombo? But we went there very briefly. It's really as a sort of Colombia. What am I talking about? Colombia. We anchored off there. It was to a group of Colombian naval cadets came on board to have a look round.
Any impressions of them?
They were interesting, smart. They haven't got much of a navy, so what they were all going to do, I'm not quite sure. But there we were.
Then where?
Then we came back home for some leave. and to join the home fleet for various exercises.
Now, what were the exercises like? Have they changed at all?
Well, the exercises, I mean, there were a tremendous range of exercises, from major fleet exercises with aircraft carriers, with foreign ships, goodness knows what, down to sort of exercises with just you and an aircraft, or you and a submarine.
Now, which type were these?
Well, a mixture of all of them.
And how did they go?
Well, sometimes they went better than others. I can't remember specifically. It was just interesting working with the Americans. And, of course, a lot of them were just the NATO exercises, which meant you had a common doctrine, a common policy, and you'd obviously work together. If you introduced another navy, then you had a problem about which signal books you were going to use or which operating techniques you were going to follow. Generally speaking, the exercises you did with them were rather lower key and a lower level than the advanced NATO exercises. I mean, working with somebody like the Dutch or the Danes, the Norwegians, Germans, it was, and Americans. You know, it's just like working with your own navies, except different ships, different languages, and different conditions on board.
And how long
we went down to Lisbon on the way to Gibraltar. Lisbon, I can't remember too much about Lisbon. We were alongside there, obviously, and that was a visit for the sailors to see, you know, Lisbon, another capital of a European country. And then down to our favourite Gib again, where we did some more exercises there. And did appear as guardship then, because we always had a...
Now, what did being guardship of Gibraltar?
Well, I did it again later as well, but I can talk more about it then, but it was in the days when we were not speaking very much to the Spaniards, and they closed the border, and they were very sensitive about their territorial waters in the bay, and they kept two rather elderly old frigates there permanently, sort of patrolling, or quite often not patrolling. One was called Smoky Joe, because it always had lots of smoke coming out of its funnel. And so we used to have a frigate there.
Just to counter them all?
Yes. To be there as a presence, really. But it was good fun. And there was always plenty to do at Gib. And then... Bacchante came back to refit in Portsmouth.
Did you stay with her during the refit, or...?
For part of the refit. In fact, the captain left and I was left in command of a ship that wasn't going anywhere but sitting in the dockyard. And then I'd then got selected for promotion to commander.
Now, what was that wasn't on the seniority, was that was on...
No, that this is the first of the big.
And what's the process whereby you're selected?
Well, I didn't find out the exact process till much later, was when I was in the staff of Commander in Chief and doing it myself. You have right from the start of your career, you have confidential reports written on you at certain stages. I mean, quite frequently, at least once a year, when you leave a ship. And that can be even on a course, something like that. So you get quite a sort of selection of these reports, which contain recommendations for promotion or not. And of course, the more senior you get, the more weight is given to these. These reports are gathered together by the Naval Secretary's Department in the Ministry of Defence. And they're whittled down to, if you like, a short list, which are then put out to the various commands, like fleet, or the fleet air arm, or Far East fleet, submarines, so on and so forth, for their admirals who have their own committee, and they select the officers for that they would like to see promoted.
Is there an interview or is it?
No.
It's just done.
Purely on report.
So you got your selection.
I was then selected for promotion to commander.
Now what happened then? Is that when you left?
In August 72, I think.
Now what happened then? So.
And so I was then pulled out of the ship. And my first job as a commander was to the Ministry of Defence Procurement Executive.
The Procurement Executive?
Yes, Mod PE. Based at, and the particular part of it I was joining was at ASWE, ASWE, which is the Admiralty Surface Weapons Establishment at Portsdown, which is on the hill overlooking Portsmouth. My specific job was to join the CDART project, CDART missile project, as the user application officer. Now, the CDART was a brand new, medium range, major missile, surface-to-air missile system, also surface-to-surface, that was going to come into... Come to sea in the new Type 42 destroyers and the new carriers. And my job was to act as the, as it says, the user officer. I was the expert who would tell all these boffins and these Admiralty civilian scientific experts, and also the contractors, how these things will be operated or work at sea.
Now, give us a bit of background about the CDART. or is it still secret?
No, it's not that secret. It was, parts of it were made by a number of firms, but the lead firm was Hawker Siddeley, as it was then. And a number of other firms were made parts of it. One firm made the fuse, another firm made the guidance system, another firm made the propulsion system, another firm made the homing system, and so all these were put together with a common aim in mind. The CDART project itself was headed at the Admiralty Surface Weapons Establishment by a captain who was a weapons engineer specialist, and he was my boss, and under him he had three commanders. Me, who was the user, the seaman if you like, was going to use it, and then two specialists, two weapons engineer commanders, and they were the technical specialists.
Tell us how the CDART works. How did the CDART work? It's a bit complicated. What type of weapon
It was a semi-active homing missile. You illuminated the target, or you detected the target, first of all, with one of the ship's early warning radars, and then you, with your fire control radar, your missile fire control radar, you locked onto the target and illuminated the target. Then you fired your missile when it came within range, when the target came within range. And the missile would home on the reflected signals from the target to the missile homing head. It had a little radar in its head as it flew up. And it had a warhead. And the warhead exploded at a certain distance, the optimum distance from the target, and hopefully hacked it down.
Now, how well did it work in comparison to some of them?
Well, I was in the very early days. It worked very well. And it was, I mean, it's still at sea now. It's on its way out now, but it's still at sea.
But no teething problems that you could...
Oh, yes, lots of teething. That's what we were there to iron out.
What kind of teething problems?
There were teething problems. There were problems with missile reliability. That's getting everything to work properly at the same time. And there were problems specifically with the homing signals and them being seduced by other things. There were problems of operating the missiles over mountainous terrain or land or other ships, all of which we ironed out. A lot of them had been foreseen beforehand. And we had to carry out a very comprehensive series of tests, including firings. And I used to go fairly often to the... we used to fire them at the firing range in Aberforth in Wales. And also to see on board HMS Bristol, which was a firing trial ship.
Now, anything else you had to do with ASWI? Or was that your sole job, the Sea Dart?
Sole job was the Sea Dart there. I did quite a lot. I got involved quite a lot in other things, but in sport, I became quite a keen member of the Dramatic Society up there. It was good. It was a good team, actually. It was a bit of a shock to the system, coming from an entirely seagoing system working for sailors and to civil servants. Who, I mean, there's no way you could get a file out of the office system before 9 o'clock in the morning, and it all had to be back at 4:30, otherwise you were left with it. And the whole place folded up sort of in the evening, mainly. Except for various scientists or naval officers who were working on their own. So it was a very different kettle of fish. Canteen at lunchtime. But all good fun. I enjoyed that too. There were good people I worked with.
How long were you doing that for? 72 to...
2 years, I think. Let's look at the
74.
Next... 2 years, and then I left there at the end of 74. Yep.